And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started.
One, two, three. Good luck. Good luck. Good luck.
Well, welcome back, Patty Quatro. I have to say, I loved our last conversation on the previous episode about the entrance of Darlene Arnone, aka Dar Thumper, the Pleasure Seekers' new drummer, as well as the introduction of Darlene Arnone's grandmother, Madame Lily Weaver, the band's Svengali seamstress and costume visionary. And so, hello, my dear. And I don't know about you, did you love that last conversation? I'd love to hear any follow-ups about Lily or the impact she had on the band, anything.
I loved what you added, and I already said it. I love that her last name was Weaver, and the metaphor of that, that she took care of us and was our stage mom, really a grandma, you know, but the Weaver, I love it. Yes, good on you.
Well, thank you. I see the story of the Pleasure Seekers and you and the Quatros as this just legendary fairy tale. And there is just something so apropos about having your costume visionary, a woman, no less, whose name is Lily Weaver. So I just thought it was too perfect, too.
It is. I loved it.
So, Patty, picking up, it's 1966. It's almost toward the end of 1966. It's another extraordinary year for the Pleasure Seekers. And it's going into 1967. And just as a reminder for the listeners, because you did have a lot of lineup changes, the new professional lineup for the Pleasure Seekers is now. It consists of the Quatro girls, you, Susie, and Arlene, as well as Eileen Bidlingmeyer, aka Lady Godiva, and, as we mentioned, drum phenom Darlene Arnone. And the one thing I wanted to say about now this year, this professional band moving on, is that I believe, and Patty, tell me what you think, I believe this is the first time the Pleasure Seekers had the full support of all of the parents, and in this case, grandmother, on board now. You no longer had parental interference.
That's true. Every single parent was, well, we had three Quatro girls in, and Darlene, her family was totally on board. I mean, we could, and Eileen's parents were fine. So, yeah, we were lucky. We had everybody's support.
It's incredible. So full steam ahead. And so one of the things that you and I talked a little bit about earlier in the season was rehearsals and putting together a musical repertoire so you can play sets and all of that. But now you're a serious working band. You're being booked all over. This is the real deal now. And so I want to talk about some of the maybe not so sexy ideas of being in a band, working and gigging, like the logistics. So I want to talk about the rehearsal space and how you were getting ready to go on tour. But also something that you and I briefly touched upon, because you are teens and we are in Detroit, and this is the car industry, is that the band pretty much soon after forming had to get some kind of transportation, not only to lug instruments, but also to get to gigs. And so I'd like you to tell us a little bit about this, the transportation of the pleasure seekers, what it was like to rehearse. And so just set the stage for us. Let's start with your van. I can't remember. It was at 1965 or 1966 that
I
it.
think it was 1966, and it cracks me up because here we are back to one of our th important things, Detroit and cars. Go right back to it.
Our pillars.
Yep.
So, did your father say, "I'm going to get you a van"? Did you say, "I need a van"? Was it a mutual decision?
It must have been. I mean, before that, we were obviously just showing up at the gig with our stuff. Nan would load her drums and, whatever. But now that Arlene was in, we had an organ and all that, Dad figured out, I mean, we did need to have a van. So I'm sure I discussed it with him. And he worked at GM. How convenient. They got a discount. So we were able to pick a van and the color and what we wanted. It was pretty freaking amazing.
Oh, I love that. Well, one of our listeners, we've mentioned him before, Kevin Stewart, happened to have lived a block away from you, the Quattros, in Grosse Pointe. You lived on Allard near Mac at that point. And he recently wrote to us and said that he and his brother have had a long-standing bet because one of them remembers that your van was painted black with pink letters of the Pleasure Seekers, and the other remembered that your van was painted pink with black letters of the Pleasure Seekers. So even though you settled this for Kevin and his brother behind the scenes, would you please tell us about the color choices of the Pleasure Seekers band and who came up with the idea of the colors? Was it you? Was it the other girls? Was it Lily? Was it your dad? I'm curious.
I'm glad to settle that bet. We definitely went for the sleek black look, and we wanted the hot pink lettering, the Pleasure Seekers. And I'm sure that was a band choice. We wouldn't have let my dad pick the colors, I mean, it was the girls and their attitude. And we were thrilled to have it. And we were going to be doing more extensive travel, so it was real important. Here we are, 1967 coming up. And we had a manager. We had a light show guy. We had Lily Weaver and Michael and Art booking us. And here we go. Now we have a van. I mean, what could be better? Our own van. It was great.
I love it.
We couldn't depend on guys flirting with us and helping unload us anymore. It was just, it was moving on to a more professional thing.
Oh, well, I love that. I also have to say, okay, so it's 1966, 1967. I know we're getting into the summer of love. I realize it's hippie time and all of that. But I just have to say, the visual of seeing a hot girl band driving a black van with hot pink lettering saying the Pleasure Seekers. I mean, the visual impact. See, this is
Oh
where
my God.
Lily Weaver continues to, I mean, that's a visual impact. Did you ever get any negative attention to this? Did people wonder what you were really selling out of that van? I'm just curious.
I'm sure they did. We would get a lot of looks like, oh, what's this? Of course, because, adults would wonder and the kids knew in short order, that it was our band van. But nothing overt. Nobody ever thought we were selling like prostitutes or something. It was fine. It was fine, but it really was important. It got the curiosity of people for sure.
Oh, I bet. I bet. And so, and just logistically, did you ever have to sleep in the van? Is that part of the reason? What was the setup of the van? Did your van ever break down? I mean, you're driving this van, your team, your teens, your girls, and you're driving this van. Tell us a few stories.
Well, it did change because we had all those elements, but we were missing one element, a roadie. So now in comes a roadie. We couldn't, I mean, we're trying to sleep. The whole back of the van was bedding and stuff. And Susie, being the loner she could be, she would sometimes go into the trailer. We had to put a trailer on to carry the equipment, and the van carried the personnel. Because I mean, we were going out of town now, okay, on little trips and stuff. So there's Susie in the back on her blankets, and she would take a Coke bottle in with her because who knew when we would stop for a pee break, and she would pee in the Coke bottle. And I remember one gig getting there and Arlene testing the sound at sound check, and she said, "My keys are all sticky. What the hell?" And Susie would never own up to it. She obviously missed her bottle, but she always had her bottle when she went into the trailer to be alone.
That is hilarious and so gross. But
Yes, it is gross.
I just want I so for me, I just want to understand because I've never driven a van and I've never driven a trailer or a U-Haul. So you're saying that the trailer was attached to the van, and so that you had to drive the van with the U-Haul in the back. That's a serious it's a serious vehicle to have to maneuver. You were driving?
I don't remember. I did drive. I knew how to do the trailer and all that, but I think we got a roadie in pretty quick order because we really needed to have one. And probably Leo drove a little bit before we located a roadie because he was with us, the manager, Leo. It worked out okay. We found a good roadie and he took over driving. So we didn't have to. We slept, and got.
Do you remember the name of your roadie?
Martin Priest.
Martin Priest. Where is he today? Do we know? Did he go on to have a career?
No, I think he's passed on. He had a very successful career in the back end with technical and all that. He was a pretty smart guy. When we would go to gigs, he would even tape the shows sometimes. He was pretty handy and he did all the equipment. Yeah, great guy.
That's fantastic. Well, as we've been talking about the logistics of being in a working hot rock and roll band, is that in order to be good, you do have to rehearse. You also have to continue to learn new songs that are happening and hip and new so that you can stay happening and new. And so our listener, Kevin from Grosse Pointe, also said that he and his friends used to sneak down to the Quattro Garage and listen to all of you practice because Kevin was too young at the time to go to the hideout, even though that was a teen club. He was preteen. So tell us what it was like to rehearse in the Quattro Garage, these endless rehearsals. What was going on in the Quattro house? Were your parents freaking out over the noise? We know they weren't. Your parents were so supportive. So talk to us a little bit about this scene at the Quattros.
Yes, let me develop this because we were at the Allard House by this time, and that's where we were practicing in the basement. And we didn't have to practice all the time because we already had our set worked up. We would go down there and practice when we needed to learn new songs now and then. But the Allard House on a main street, Mack Avenue, was a huge hangout. That's what it became into 1967. It was like a happening and it was sporadic. It wasn't weekly. It just people started hanging, and it was noisy in the garage where we were playing, but my parents' bedroom were at the other end of the house. We were on a main street, so there was noise from traffic, so it wasn't as noticeable. And right next to the garage where we rehearsed was an empty lot. We lucked out. We really did. And then there was one neighbor on one side of us, not the Mac side, the other side. And they didn't seem to be bothered. It was an elderly couple. Maybe they were half deaf. I guess they'd have to be. So So, there was no neighbor complaints. We didn't get the police stopping by or anything. That only happened when Susie and Nancy later would call the police to stop me from calling a practice. And they did that
We'll hold that story because I love that story so much. But that is later. Well, it's funny because you said you never had any neighbor complaints. No, if anything, you had neighborly fans. You already
Yes.
had fans listening even in your garage. And so for the listeners, I actually got to visit your Allard house off of Mac with your brother over the holidays. So I will be posting a picture of it, although it probably, your brother Mike said it didn't look that different. The only difference is that now there is a home behind. There is no empty lot anymore, but it is
Oh.
behind you, but it is still equally as noisy and you still could probably rehearse in that garage. So I'm curious, Patty, how did then these rehearsals in the garage lead to your parents opening up the Quattro home for these happenings, as you said, which would sometimes turn into jam sessions. I'm curious. I love this thought, this idea.
It was so organic. There was no plan. My parents didn't even give us permission. Okay. We just did it. We'd be jamming and some homeboys would show up, Mitch or Scott from SRC, Ted Nugent, whoever, we all knew each other. And sometimes it would be after a gig or, they were so sporadic. It wasn't weekly. And then it started getting around and we would have fans and kids showing up. Nancy would invite her friends and there we'd be sometimes not even in the garage. We would take over the damn living room. I don't know where mom and dad were hiding out somewhere else, but they didn't mind. They were so cool with it. And the living room was tiny. It would be filled with people and Susie would be singing on the mic. My dad had an organ in there, so Arlene would be playing some organ and I'd be on my guitar. It was very organic and spontaneous. So that's how it went. And sometimes it was in the living room with friends and some people, or we had some name band that had just done a concert and wanted to come over and jam at the Quattro house. So we had both types, the garage jams and the living room jams. And Dad, he would get involved. Anybody that wanted to talk music to him, he would talk music. He would pull out his Bible. He would test some of the homeboy musicians. Like, they would play a lick or something. He'd say, "Oh, that's not new." And he'd pull out his Bible of songs and he'd say, "This is where that came from." And they would argue and he would get into debates. He enjoyed a lot of it, but it wasn't like he was hanging at the party. But people would wander, and he would talk with them. He was so outgoing.
Well, he
So,
might not have been a part of the party, maybe per se, but I
no.
know, for example, from one of your homeboys, Scott Richardson, that both your parents were very influential on some of your homeboys and in talking about music, your dad from this music Bible, and showing and teaching these young rockers what's
Yep.
going on and that they have a thing or two to learn as well. And your dad, being ever the charmer, did it so wonderfully. So tell us a little bit more of some of your memories of these soirees with your dad or anything you want to share.
Oh, I have to bring up my dad because these are a couple funny things. He was such a strange example of a crazy personality that inhabited him. He had such a sense of humor. He was a joke a minute. Cornball jokes, and Susie inherited that talent. She tells the corniest stupid jokes I've ever heard. And we had roadies living in the basement, as I said, so they'd be at the parties, right? And after one particular party, I remember this one, it was hilarious. It was toward the end of the party. And I don't know if the roadie had imbibed too much beer or whatever. So at the end of the party, my dad pulls me aside, right? Totally deadpan face and trying to hide a smirk or a laughter, trying to be serious. I could see right through that. He said, "Your roadie stripped down and he is now on Mack Avenue chasing down a bus, butt naked, singing some kind of Dickie 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 song." And he ended with a complete through this whole thing. He has a straight face. He said, "You better go get him before he gets hurt or arrested." I mean, My dad was a musician. In these moments that happened through the years, it felt like nothing surprised my dad much. He just took it in stride, and there was always a surprise around the corner. I must say, he was a stinker. He really was. Him and
Wait,
my.
wait, I want to hear the other. I'm choking on this. What is the Dickie 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 song?
I wish I knew the words he was singing. That's how Dad represented it. Dickie, 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 and he's chasing this bus in the traffic. I mean, what an idiot.
Oh my, that's hilarious. I also love what a seasoned musician he was to not even care that the guy was buck naked. More like, Patty, you better go. You better go take care of this guy.
Nothing got him. I remember a funny one when we were at one of the weddings of the family, and we had to go. This is my dad all the way. This describes him, okay? We had to go to confession. We're brought up Catholic, right? My mother was serious Catholic. My dad, not so much. Him and Mickey were the stinkers. They were not religious. So Dad goes in to do his confession. You know, we're all there. And Mickey turns and says, he's gonna lie. Know what he meant. So Dad comes out like in a nanosecond after going in the confessional. And he was asked what he had to say that was so quick. And his answer was, bless me, Father, I've done one of everything. End of story. And that was the kind of cue. I can't believe he said that to the priest. And he walked.
Hilarious. Do we know if the priest laughed? No, of course we don't know.
I don't know. I just couldn't believe he did that. But, he was in and out.
Oh, I love these stories about your dad so much. Please just share anything and anything you want to at any moment about Art Quattro. He is the musical patriarch after all. But also, Patty, you've been teasing us now since I think season one of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast that you could read a list of all of your homeboys and other bands the Pleasure Seekers played and hung with, and that it would take at least over an hour. And you've said that, you've teased us multiple times, but oh, it would take over an hour. So instead of reading a list like, let's say, an hour-long phone book reading, I would like you to tease out some of these stories. So instead of being, let's say, a phone book, it could be a little black book of stories. So tell us a little bit about who these homeboys are, because we're about to now embark on playing with them, hanging even more with them, jamming with them. Just tease us a little, Patty.
This is when it starts, I have to say. This moment of escalation going into 67 and 68, it was intense. And we were going more mainstream. And we were the earliest band out of Detroit. Everybody wanted the girl band that they'd heard about. It was a very important thing for women and for the hometown bands, you know? So there was a lot of excitement. Career moves and a lot going on, and I know you're going to drag it all out of me.
You know
Oh, yeah. And
it.
yes, we had the phone book, the infamous phone book of bands we jammed with, played with, interacted with, hung with. And then we had our black book. And that's the one I know you want to hear because it involves who we dated, all the stories, and the drama. So it is two different books, definitely. We did date. We did date, some famous people and all that. There's no doubt about that.
Well, then let's just say you have the phone book and the little black book, and they're perfect bookends.
Yes, exactly. Oh, so many. We were playing all over the US. So you can imagine, we played on so many festivals and combo gigs and stuff, and just places, even certain club gigs where they had major rock stars playing with us, because clubs were a big thing then. So there were so many of that era that we played with.
Well, part of the reason why I wanted you to share with us on this episode about the behind-the-scenes stories of getting a van, putting together the van, getting a U-Haul, is that, as you said, Pleasure Seekers now is about to take off in terms of your success outside of Detroit, Michigan. You are about to start gigging everywhere. This is the van and the U-Haul. You're going to be not only with your homeboys gigging with them, but also you're going to be meeting new fanboys. You're going to be dating and playing with your national and international rock boys. I mean, the stories really are endless, and I've been privy to have heard so many of them, so people, listeners. So first, Patty, give us the details. What's the first thing as we're about to go on tour now with you, as you're packing up the van? I don't mean the U-Haul. We know the roadie is loading up the equipments, but as a working girl band, your teens, you're getting ready. Tell us, besides Lily Weaver's costumes, what goes into a van? What goes into packing up for touring with the Pleasure Seekers?
Well, it was a little different for girls than it would be for boys, the things we needed. But again, at this point, we were still going home sometimes, maybe a weekend away, or we were on a longer stint. So we had to pack appropriately for how long we were going to be gone, which obviously included all the costuming and, maybe bigger amps. By then, we were starting soon, we're sponsored by amp companies and stuff. So as 67 comes in, the equipment is even more voluminous. So everything started escalating and changing. And oh my God. So when we were at Detroit, we had the interaction still with the homeboys, okay? We had the rehearsal farm shenanigans with Alice Cooper and his boys, and the infamous car chase with Mr. Nugent and the skinny bitch girlfriend. We had the plastic dipshit band with Cubby Coda and Brownsville. And that's not even touching all of the name bands like the Animals, Leslie & Mountain, Blues Magoos, Canned Heat, so many more, and The Who. So many interactions,
Okay,
so much going
hold on,
on.
my dear. Hold on. I love that you just skipped over. You gave a nice little and the who. And then you quickly jumped over that. So I am just going to tease you and say, yes, you not only played with the who, you played with the
I knew you'd get that in there somewhere.
somewhere, and I'm not letting this one go. I have been so patient on this. We're talking
Oh,
since season one, so I can't wait to hear about all of these bands, most especially The Who, but please keep going.
my God. Well, you had, here we go, 67, 68. You have the Pleasure Seekers hitting New York City. You have all these mafia mob events, scary as shit, and so many incidents that happened on the road with women. It's a different thing. We're women. We had the contracts, recording, tons of gigs. We were held over at gigs. We have, oh my God, one of them, Martin Luther King being shot, and we had an incident at the famous Gorham Hotel, and the Who were there. Of course, the Who.
Of course,
Oh,
the Who were there. And you
who
see,
else would be there with us?
I
We have the Southern tours and people breaking into our hotel rooms and stealing things. And the Ex-Lax story, that's a good one. And the New Jersey mob bar drama and an incident with Chuck Berry. I mean,
Well, and
Norfolk,
let's,
oh my God,
Patty,
just
let's
so
not
much to come.
say that again. You cut out.
So much to come.
So much to come. And also, let's not forget 1967 in the summer, Detroit riots, the civil unrest riots. And the Pledge Seekers were here when that was happening. And that's another story that we'll get to. I mean, you are now experiencing the mid to late 60s and all the success, excitement, hippiedom, and love, but also the fierce racism and hatred and just so much chaos going on, and there all of you are in the middle of it. So,
My God, you know what? I could go on forever with the dramas and the hilarity, and we will. Everything now ratcheted up in a new, huge manner. And truly, I'm just scratching the surface of what road life will be coming up. Strap in. Touring was like going to college in a different way. It was like a worldly, rounded way. It was such an education to us women being so young. Better than college, in my view. I mean, I'm prejudiced, but I learned so much on the road and leaving the comfort of Detroit. We were a shit hot band, now gaining momentum and reputation. All I can say is that we were cocked, locked, and ready to rock. And boy, did we.
Oh, I love it. Well, as we end this episode, I want to say to our listeners, buckle up, everyone. The Pleasure Seekers van is in gear. We're pulling out of the Quattro household from Allard onto Mac, and we are ready to go. You ready, Patty?
I'm so ready. Are you kidding?
Feel free.